Mark, thank you very much for the good song leading again tonight. Glad that everybody's here. Hope that you've got your Bible, and if you do, you might open to the book of Matthew. That's where we've been this week, Matthew. And tonight we're going to look at chapter 20, or a short portion of chapter 20. Before we get into that, I'll make these comments short. I've come here to do some work, and so we won't take any time, too much time away from that. But I want to say a few things before we get started, because when I'm done, I'm done. I won't say anything more afterwards. So let me just say a couple things here as we get started tonight. I've got in my house, in my dining room, in the kitchen, I've got a framed photograph of a group, a room full of children. When I lived over on Morgan Street, some 20-some years ago, I've got a picture of all of the children that were here. That was a real special season for this church, and it was a real special season in my life. I really appreciated the opportunity to be here when I was young. This is the first place I ever preached full time, and I've thought often about that. It's here 3 years, and I've often thought about that. I wish that I could have done a better service for you. You deserved better, and your children deserved better. Of course, you don't know what you don't know until you know enough to know that you didn't know. I really appreciate that. I appreciate the time I had here with you, and I've really looked forward to doing this gospel meeting for you, and I've hoped some of the things that we've talked about have been encouraging to you, and I've wanted to build you up in that way. But I want you to know, I've really appreciated that. I treasured that time so very much, and I'm so very thankful for that. I cherish that picture, And it's just so very special to me. You all are very special to me. The church here is very special to me. And like I said, I'm really glad that I've been able to be here this week. I really enjoy also coming down once a month. And so I'll probably see you in a couple weeks. Anyway, we're in the book of Matthew tonight. Matthew chapter 20 is where we're at. We're going to talk a little bit about commitment this evening. I am committed to Jesus. Are you committed to Jesus? I'm sure you are. If you weren't, you probably wouldn't be here tonight. I know you're committed to Jesus, right? I'm committed to Jesus, and I want to do big things for Jesus. Well, what does that look like? That's what we're going to talk about. Now, of course, we've been somewhat on a journey with Matthew. We've come to believe in Jesus. I know we haven't gone through every chapter, but some of the things that we've talked about that this week will sound familiar to you, right? We've seen how Jesus calms the storm on the sea. The disciples are with Jesus in the boat. We talked about them coming to believe. Matthew is making this point in the first half of the Gospel of Matthew. He's cultivating this belief in the man Jesus, in who he is. Jesus calms the storm on the sea, and the disciples, his own disciples who are with him, who believe in him, say, "What manner of man is this that even the winds and the waves obey him?" They have some great trust in Jesus, but how much more when they're blown away by what he is capable of doing with nature itself? And so Matthew's cultivating this belief, and we're with Matthew, we're with the disciples there in the boat, we're looking through Matthew's eyes, and we also are in astonishment wondering, who is this Jesus that even the winds and the waves obey him? In Matthew chapter 9, Jesus heals the paralyzed man. But before he does so, or the reason that he does so, is because he's announced that the man's sins are forgiven. And the people begin questioning, well, who can forgive sins but God alone? And in order to demonstrate that he has power, he has the authority to forgive sins, he also causes the man to walk. He can heal the body. He can heal the soul. What manner of man is this? We're watching these things with Matthew. We talked about John questioning there in chapter 11 where he's in prison. He had announced Jesus to be the Messiah, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world when Jesus came out to be baptized. But sometime later, now that he's in prison, he begins doubting Are you the expected one, or should we look for someone else? And Jesus' response is simply, what does the Bible say? What does the Bible say? Go and tell John what you see and what you hear. The deaf hear and the lame walk. The blind are receiving sight. We didn't talk about chapter 12, but there's this interaction with Jesus and the Pharisees. That'd be a wonderful thing to study at some point. Just the way that people argue, and sometimes unfairly, and that's really what the Pharisees are doing there. But we've on this journey with Matthew, looking at Jesus through Matthew's eyes, until we come to chapter 16, halfway through the book, and Peter makes the confession. Who do people say that I am? Well, some people think that you're John the Baptist, and some people think you're one of the prophets of the old. Who do you say that I am? Peter confesses, you are the Christ. You are God's anointed. You are the King of Israel. And we agree with Peter. We agree with Peter. We've come to believe in Jesus too. We've been on this journey with him. But it's not just belief in Jesus the man, but also God's method. We talked about this last night. What is Jesus without the cross? We've come to believe in God's method. Jesus foretells his death here in chapter 16, and he does so again later. He tells the disciples the cost of being one of his followers means that they also will have to take up a cross. And what that cross will look like, what that cross looks like, I don't know. What your cross will look like, I don't know. We looked at chapter 18, 19. There's examples there of what it looks like to bear a cross. What your specific cross may be, I don't know. But know this, every one of us has a cross to bear. What is Jesus without the cross? He may be God, but he is not a Savior. What are you without taking up your cross and following him? I told you last night, I don't enjoy that message. That's not one that's easy to absorb. I know it's true. I want to be where Jesus is. I want what he offers. But hearing that message, absorbing that message that there's a cross that I have to bear and that you do too, is not something that I enjoy. But I believe it's true. We've come to believe in Jesus' means, the cross. Now we're going to talk about Jesus' definition of commitment. Do you believe in Jesus' definition of what it means to be great? If I'm going to do something, I want to do it well. I want to be the very best that I can be at whatever I'm doing. Do you trust Jesus' definition of greatness? With that in mind, go to chapter 20. Because James and John in chapter 20, James and John want to be great. They want to be great. Read these verses with me if you will. This is Matthew chapter 20. And we're going to read in verse 20 and go down through verse 28. Matthew chapter 20 and beginning in verse 20. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making request of him. Now, in Luke's gospel, I think it's in Luke's gospel, Luke tells us that it's the boys that come. Matthew gives us this detail that mom comes with them. I don't know, maybe she thinks that maybe she'll have some sort of maternal ploy or pull with Jesus. But whatever the case is, Jesus responds to the boys here. Jesus responds to James and John. He says to her, what do you wish? That's a good way of responding to people when they ask, I want you to do something for me. Well, give me some more information. What is it that you want? Before I agree to it, tell me what you want. What do you wish? And she said to him, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right and on your left. But Jesus answered, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? Notice that he's speaking to the sons here. He's speaking to James and John. They said to him, we are able. And he said to them, my cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared by my Father. And hearing this, the 10 became indignant with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. They make sure everybody knows who's the boss. And their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Now notice that the disciples, the other disciples, that these are, they're angry with the two brothers. And I wonder, well, why are they angry with the two brothers? Maybe it's just the fact that they didn't think to ask first. I mean, they might have been thinking, well, if I had known that the job opportunity was open, you know, if the position of left and right seats in Jesus' kingdom, if I had known that those were up for grabs, I would have called dibs already, but I didn't know. And so maybe they're angry because of that. But they're angry with James and John because they've asked for this. I've got these headings in my text. Maybe you have headings like this as well. And the heading I have for these verses says preferential treatment or preferment is asked. I don't know that that's what James and John are asking for. I don't know that they're asking for preferential treatment. I don't think that that's what they're asking for. But the other disciples are angry that James and John have asked for these positions. Now, of course, the disciples, they've often argued about who is the most important and who is the greatest. There are a couple examples of this back in chapter 18. These are all similar examples. Chapter 18 of Matthew, chapter 9 of Mark, and chapter 9 of Luke. Those are all the same example, just given in the three different gospel accounts. But chapter 22, this one's really important. Do you know what's happening in chapter 22? The disciples are going to argue about who is the greatest. But what happens in chapter 22? I'll give you kind of a hint. Chapter 22, there's only two more chapters in the Gospel of Luke. It ends at chapter 24. So what might be happening at the end of these Gospels? This is right before Jesus is crucified. This is the last evening Jesus is with his disciples before he is betrayed and ultimately crucified. And right before this moment when he sacrifices all of himself, the disciples are arguing about who's the most important. It's not just the fact that they're arguing, but it's punctuated. Can you feel the piercing in his heart, in Jesus' heart, that the people that he is serving are arguing with each other about who's the most important? I think what's interesting about the disciples arguing is that each one of them felt that they had a case to be made. Each of these disciples, all 12 of them, thought that they had a reason for feeling like they were the most important. And I wonder about that. What evidence would these disciples have been able to give that they were the most important? I mean, think about somebody like Andrew. What would Andrew even say? How would Andrew make the case that he was the most important? I don't know what he would have said. Maybe he would have said something like, well, you know, I was one of the first, because Andrew and John, they were disciples of John the Baptist before. And so maybe we are the original disciples. Our belief goes further back than anyone's. You know, I've been a member of the church longer than anybody has been a member of the church. Maybe that's why they felt that they were the greatest. Or maybe he would have said, well, you know, maybe I'm not so important, but I know Peter's important. But Peter wouldn't be anything if it hadn't been for me bringing him to Jesus. Or, well, of course, we could think about Peter, James, and John. They have a legitimate case to be made, right, for being greatest. They could have reasoned out that Jesus himself singles us out. How many times do we see Peter, James, and John being taken off by themselves with Jesus? So we talked about the Mountain of Transfiguration. Peter gets this peek behind the veil to see Jesus as he truly is. And so maybe he makes the case that he's the most important because Jesus is often singling us out. Well, what about Judas? Can you even Judas could make the case that how would Judas say that he's the most important? Everybody knows he's the bad guy. What possibility could he have for making the case that he was most important? I'll tell you, his is the easiest one. You know what he would have said? I don't know that this is what he said. The Bible doesn't tell us what evidence they gave. But if I put myself in Judas's shoes, the case I would make for being most important is, I'm the one with the money. Everybody knows if you're the one with the checkbook, you are the most vital to the church. Right? I say that a bit sarcastically, but that is often the way that we function. Whoever has the most money or whoever has the checkbook for the church, they're important. They're the most important. They make the decisions. So even Judas could have made this case that he's the most important. Let's talk a little bit about greatness and great commitment. Go back to chapter 19. Go back to chapter 19. I want you to notice this statement that disciples make. This is in verse 27. In verse 27, the disciples say, Peter says, "Behold, we have left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us?" What Peter's talking about is his level of commitment. And I know that because, as we talked about last night, the story of the rich young ruler, this is a story of bearing a cross. Does every disciple have to give all of their possessions away in order to follow Jesus? No. But this man did. That was his cross to bear. Notice what's said here in verse 21. Well, 20 and 21, the young man said to him, "All these things I have kept from my, what am I still lacking?" Jesus says to him, "If you wish to be complete, go and sell your possessions, give to the poor, and then you'll have treasure in heaven. Come follow me." Go and sell. Notice the response after this man leaves, grieved. Because he's one who owns much property, he cannot bear the cross. He turns his back on Jesus. Peter steps up and Peter says, "Jesus, we have left everything to follow you." Our commitment is sincere. Our commitment is great. What will there be for us? You think about Matthew. Matthew has left the income of a tax collector. Now, I don't know that he was a thief, but oftentimes they're portrayed as being well off. He's left a lucrative business. The other four, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, they have left their fishing business. And James and John have left their father, not abandoned him, but they're off doing something different now. Jesus has changed their life. They are to be fishers of men now. And other disciples, they've all left something, haven't they? What Peter says about himself, he's really saying about all of these disciples, "We have left everything for you, Jesus. Our commitment is great." And so Jesus' response to Peter, to James and John then, I think is really interesting. Again, in chapter 20, when Jesus asks them, "Do you know," or he asks them, "Are you able to drink from the cup that I am about to drink?" There in chapter 20 and verse 22, "You do not know what you are asking." Do you think Jesus is telling the truth about that? You think he's right about that? "You do not know what you're asking to sit on my left and on my right. You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup from which I am about to drink?" No, I don't think they do understand what Jesus is talking about. Do you think they know what he means by cup, What cup are you talking about, Jesus? What are you going to drink? They didn't even need to ask the question. That's the level of their commitment. Jesus, I don't care what you got in that cup. I'll drink it. If you're talking about a cup. I don't even know what you're talking about, Jesus. Cups, not cups, whatever you got in the cup, I don't care, Jesus. If you put it before me, I'll drink it. That's my level of commitment. Whatever you want me to do, that's what I'll do. That's what they're saying. They're not asking for preferential treatment. James and John come to Jesus, they don't want titles. What they're telling Jesus is, Jesus, I am committed to your cause and I'm committed to you. If you need something done, we're your guys. We'll get it done. Make us your lieutenants. We don't need the titles, but make us your lieutenants. We will get the job done. We're committed to you, Jesus. Do you know what you're asking for? No, they don't. They really don't. How many times in your life have you realized after the fact that you did not know you were jumping into the deep end? You don't know until you jump in, right? That's where they're at. But it doesn't matter to them. Jesus, whatever you want us to do, we'll do it. We're committed to you. I don't have to know. I don't have to know all the ins and outs about it. Whatever you want done, Jesus, you just ask us. We'll get it done. They're committed to Jesus. And all the disciples say the same thing, right? All of the disciples make the same case. In Matthew chapter 26, all of the disciples are saying this, we will go to our deaths with you, Jesus. Not just Peter, all of the disciples. Matthew chapter 26 and verse 33. Chapter 26 and verse 33, but Peter said to him, even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. And then verse 35, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And all the disciples said the same thing. All of them are committed to Jesus. Jesus, we're willing to die with you. If that means drinking some poison, I'll drink the poison, Jesus. It doesn't matter. They all said the same thing. Or look at this passage over in Luke 22. Look at the way it's phrased here. Luke 22 and verse 33. Luke 22 and verse 33. And he said to them, or he said to him, Lord, with you I am ready to both go to prison and to death. I don't care what the cup is, Jesus. I'll drink it. Or I like this one. This one's in John chapter 13. This is not at the end of Jesus' ministry. This is about Thomas. And what is Thomas usually called? You know what Thomas is called. What's his nickname? Doubting Thomas, right? Doubting Thomas. Because after Jesus is raised from the dead, he says, I will not believe unless I can put my fingers into his pierced side and see the nail prints in his hands. Unless I can see those things, touch those things, experience that, I will not believe. But notice his belief here in John chapter 13. In John chapter 13 and verse 37, John 13 and verse 37. No, that's not the one I want. It must be this next one. There it is, chapter 11. Chapter 11 and verse 16. Chapter 11 and verse 16. Therefore, Thomas, who is called Didymus, some people think he's called Didymus, meaning twin or something like that. That, you know, maybe he had a brother, maybe he had a twin brother. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. It's kind of interesting, some of the names that these disciples have, like Peter. Peter is a nickname meaning rock, but it's kind of a twofold. It's kind of a twofold name. What kind of rock are you going to be, Peter? Are you going to be this strong foundational rock, or are you just going to be a big pile of gravel that crumbles when somebody tries to lean on it? Peter displays both of those from time to time. Jesus gives nicknames to James and John, the sons of thunder, because they want to call down fire from heaven. I wonder if this isn't also a nickname. Thomas, he kind of waffles back and forth. We see him doubting in places, but what does he display here? John chapter 11 and verse 16, "Therefore Thomas, who was called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples," they're complaining about going with Jesus to Jerusalem because we just escaped with our lives before. But Thomas says, "Let us go also so that we may die with him." Well, that sounds like commitment to me. All of these disciples display this same kind of commitment. Great commitment. Loyal, strong, devout. And listen, I want to do big things for Jesus too. The fact that the disciples, Jesus' disciples, the apostles, the fact that these apostles, these men are jockeying for position shouldn't be surprising. When I look at myself in the mirror, when I try to be as honest as I can with my heart, the heart is deceptively wicked, but if I try to be as honest as I can about who I am, that shouldn't surprise me. Because I'm prideful and I'm tempted with ambition. Now, I don't think I'm unique in that. I think many of us are this way. The fact that I'm confessing to you, confessing that I'm tempted with pride is not a shame, I don't think, not a shame to me. But if I was blind to this pride, or if I should say things that being ambitious is beneath me, I ought to be ashamed of that. As though I could never be tempted with such evil things. I'm a man. I'm a man. I'm a sinner. I'm broken. I have issues of pride. I'm tempted with ambition, all the same ways that all other men are tempted. I tell you something, it's kind of humorous to me now as I look back on these kind of things. I remember when I was a child thinking, I remember going to some gospel meetings and going to some debates with my dad, and really looking up to these preachers and thinking, one of these days I'm going to do those kind of things. One of these days I'm going to charge out into the world and be some great debater. And I am not. I've been humbled many times. I'm not. One of my most humiliating defeats was with a 12-year-old girl and her twin sister, my daughters. And I realized that if I can't out-debate a 12-year-old girl, I'm not going to be much of a debater. Listen, I used to think that, you know, great preachers were in big churches, and great preachers held lots of meetings. It makes me think of the fantasies that boys have when they're small. And they look at some military man, has a chest full of medals. Oh, he must be a real hero. Look at that chest full of medals that he has. When I was a boy, my dad had all of his military clothes in a duffel bag, and my brothers and I got into it, and we'd dress up and play army, and you know, we just dressed up in all of his clothes. I remember going over to my grandpa Werfel's house and asking him about his army clothes. And more than that, we wanted to see his medals because we knew that grandpa had been in Korea. And we wanted to see his medals because we're fascinated. Little boys are fascinated by shiny things. My grandpa told me that he didn't have them. He didn't have them. He said, when they told me I could go home, I just came home. I've often thought about that. I thought, well, I can picture my grandpa. If you knew my grandpa, maybe you could picture this too. I pictured my grandpa when they told him that he could go home just kind of stripped off all of his army gear and pulled on his overalls, jumped in the ocean, and swam all the way from Korea back here to Illinois. He didn't want anything to do with medals. I used to think that great preachers preached in big churches. Sometimes the opposite boast sets in, and I think now, no. Great preachers preach in small churches because that's where the greatest need is. I don't know if you've ever read this book. Many people, if you've read anything by C.S. Lewis, it might be the Narnia books, The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. If you've read some of his other works, you might be familiar with Mere Christianity. It's okay. In my opinion, my humble opinion, it's okay. I'm convinced, though, that Lewis is a genius. And it's because of this book here, The Screwtape Letters. If you haven't read it, it's not very long. Most of his books aren't too big. But this is brilliant. It's brilliant. I promise you, it's brilliant. The Screwtape Letters. So what the Screwtape Letters is about, it is about an elder demon writing letters. His name is Screwtape. He's writing letters to his nephew, a lower demon. And it's all about how to tempt people. We're called patience in the book. But it's wonderfully set up. It's set up like a business. Hell's pictured as a business venture where you have upper management training under management, training the workers on how to tempt people. And I tell you that Lewis is a genius because of his insight into the nature of people. I want to read a short snippet from one of the chapters. This is chapter 14. This is one of the letters. So Screwtape writes, he says, "I see only one thing to do at the moment. Your patient," the person that he's working on tempting, "your patient has become humble. Have you drawn attention to the fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them. But this is specifically true of humility. Catch him at a moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, 'I'm being humble.' And almost immediately, pride. Pride at his own humility will appear. Now, if he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, make him proud of his attempt." And so on, through as many stages as you please, but don't try this too long, for fear you will awake his sense of humor and proportion, in which case he will merely laugh at you and go to bed. Pride at his own humility. What does greatness look like? What does it mean to be a really great disciple of Jesus? What does it mean to be a great Christian? What does it mean to be great? The disciples, James and John, they truly are committed. They want to demonstrate that to Jesus. "Jesus, I'll do anything for you. I don't care what it is. I don't even have to know what it is, Jesus. You just set it before me and I'll do it. I'll drink it. I don't care." It's interesting what Jesus responds with, isn't it? Jesus tells them that the greatest serve the most, and they serve the most unimportant. Read again with me, if you will. This is chapter 20, Matthew chapter 20. And now verse 25 again. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 25. And let's read down through that end of the section where we ended before. Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them." They make sure everybody knows who is boss, either because they boss people around or because they have the medals or the shiny things that let you know they are in charge. Or maybe it's because we stand on platforms above everybody else while they sit quietly and listen to everything we have to say. They lord it over them. And their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you, and don't miss the impact of this, shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus turns their attention from himself to his servants. I want to do big things for Jesus. You want to do great things for Jesus, right? I want to serve Jesus. Jesus says, if you want to serve me, serve my people. No, Jesus, you misunderstand. I want to serve you, Jesus. I want to serve you. Anybody here have a problem washing Jesus' feet? Anybody have a problem with washing Jesus' feet? If Jesus were here, anybody have a problem with that? Not a one of us, right? We'd fight over the opportunity to wash Jesus' feet. I don't know about anybody else's feet, though. Yeah, this principle, the way that we treat Jesus' people reflects the way that we treat Him. It's seen throughout the Scriptures, right? It's seen all over the place. Matthew chapter 25, to the extent that you did it to one of the least of these brothers of mine, you've done so to me. When did we see you hungry? When did we see you thirsty? When did we see you naked and clothe you? When were you in prison and we came and visited you? When did we see any of that with you, Jesus? We would certainly do that for you. To the extent that you did or did not do so to one of the least of these brothers of mine, you have or you haven't done for me. The way that we treat God's people reflects the way that we would treat God, the way we would treat Jesus. So, let me finish with this. So, who is it then? We started with the question about sitting on the left and right hand of Jesus in His kingdom. Well, who does have those places? Who does have those places? I don't know. I don't know, but I'll give you a guess. If I had to guess, from the things we've talked about tonight and the way some of this is set up, if I had to guess who it is that's going to sit on the left and right hand of Jesus, I'll tell you this, it's not going to be a preacher. Big preacher, small preacher, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not going to be a preacher. Probably not going to be an elder. Probably not. Probably not going to be somebody that's wrote a lot of commentaries. Probably not going to be an editor of some religious paper. College professor at some Bible university. No, probably not. Probably not. Who's going to sit on Jesus' left and right? If I had to guess, it's probably going to be two little old women that none of us know her name, who has served a lot of other unnamed people. Who's going to sit on the left and right hand of Jesus? Who's the greatest? Probably somebody whose name I do not know, who has served countless other peoples whose names I do not know. The greatest serve the most, and they serve the most unimportant people. You want to do good? You want to do great things for Jesus? Then do great things for the least of his people. If there's someone here tonight that needs to put Jesus Christ on in baptism and start that walk with him, we invite you to come. If we could pray with you, if we could pray for you, if you've grown weak and discouraged, let's build each other up. If we can assist you and help you, come while we stand and sing.